Hello friends, you're listening to the Four Cubits and a Span podcast, the layperson's conversation about ancient biblical narrative in the life of the modern believer. Thanks for downloading or streaming this summer hiatus special episode. I'm Dan Abson.
And I'm Jo Kitchen.
So at the beginning of May, in an episode, we looked at Deuteronomy chapter 22. And the second half of that chapter, all of the material that I recorded on that got completely cut because it went on for about 10 minutes on its own. But I also thought it was really valuable. So when I came this summer to bring back some of these little segments that I cut, I went and asked for some help to figure out why it hadn't quite seemed entirely finished to me. I asked some of my sisters in Christ to help me out with things that I'd missed. And Jo kindly agreed to come on and re-record the whole thing with me. Hi, Jo.
Hi, I did indeed. Yeah, I really enjoy listening to podcasts, and Dan's podcast is one of the ones I enjoy listening to. So when given the chance to offer feedback, well, it's a lot easier to critique someone else's work than to do it yourself. But then when Dan asked me if I would come and join him in re-recording this bit of the podcast, it seemed like a good opportunity.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I really appreciate you coming on to chat this through. So, quick bit of context. In the original episode, we were talking about the nature of the law codes in Torah. That some of them are kind of understandable, some of them are kind of cryptic, but all of them in some way are related to the worldview of the ancient Israelites. And that's why sometimes some details stand out as being odd, or in the case of the end of Deuteronomy 22, some details stand out as being fairly horrifying. One of the bits of feedback I had was a recommendation to listen to the Bible Project podcasts on Torah and on how Torah works, and specifically on how the law codes work. And they made a really interesting point that when we come to read law codes from our kind of Western democracies, we're used to statutory law. So you literally have a book of regulations, and the courts and the judges, they spend all their time trying to figure out exactly how to apply the words that are written to any given situation. Whereas in Torah, these law codes are more a common law framework. So underneath all of these laws is a whole worldview, a whole notion of natural justice, and lots of things that aren't actually written down, which the original audience all took for granted because it was just part of the way that they viewed the world. So in this special episode, we're looking at verses 13 to 30 in Deuteronomy chapter 22 and the ways in which the text treats women and men and how Torah legislates, if you like, the issue of extramarital sex. So we're going to be discussing rape, sexual abuse, marital abuse, sexual purity culture, and the canonization in divine law of abusive and potentially abusive sexual ethics. There are links to groups and resources that support people who have suffered rape and abuse in the show notes on the website www.fourcubitsandaspan.com.
I think we'll do our best to be sensitive and use the right words, but it's quite different discussing this or listening to it if you've actually been a victim in this sort of situation. So I hope you'll sort of appreciate that we are trying our best in this episode, but might not get it right all the time.
Yeah, thanks for bearing with us as we talk through this stuff. Okay, so the first part of this chunk of Deuteronomy 22 starts in verse 13 and runs to verse 21. It's kind of interesting in that it begins with an accusation by a man against his new wife, which this law begins by describing as a false accusation. So here's what to do if your new husband falsely accuses you of not being a virgin on your wedding night. So I think a few times on the podcast we've talked about why this might have been considered important in this sort of ancient culture. This is a culture, especially for the Israelites, this is also tied up with their theology of covenant. It's all about inheritance and the legitimacy of a particular family line or kind of clan mandate for possessing the land. And especially for the Deuteronomist, writing at the time of the monarchy, this kind of underpins the whole right of the Israelites to be in the land and have a monarchy in the first place. That doesn't necessarily make any of this any less disturbing, but it can give us a reason within the world of this story, within the world of this people, to explain why this emphasis is here, although there are other reasons that we'll probably come across. Basically, if your new husband accuses you of not being a virgin on your wedding night, you present the evidence, or rather, the girl's father and mother, this is verse 15, should take the proof of her virginity to the elders of the town at the town gate.
This does make you think, have they just held on to a bloody cloth for like an indeterminate length of time? Is it, you just sort of wonder in that culture, is this something that routinely before the wedding night, the mum would be to the daughter, well, this is what you need to gather so you've got proof that we can hold on to it? Or is this something actually that was unlikely to happen? I don't know, just lots of extra questions.
Yeah, it is weird. It would be kind of weird for the father and mother to kind of storm the room in the morning and grab the bedsheets.
Yeah, it would. But then there are examples of blooded bedsheets being hung up the next morning. I'm thinking a little bit more Tudors here. Yeah. But it's not a thing just about this Israelite culture.
Yes, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, it's a problematic test in the first place. Not all women bleed the first time they have penetrative sex. The hymen, a very thin kind of piece of skin covering the entrance to the vagina, may have already broken. The activity usually given likely to cause that, horse riding, even rope climbing. And also sometimes it just doesn't bleed. The blood supply is fairly low.
And it could also be faked fairly easily as well, couldn't it? So it just does seems an odd bit of proof to put so much emphasis on.
Yes, yeah, and if the woman happens to not bleed, she then has to trust her husband, so she's immediately vulnerable.
Yeah.
Her husband has to believe her.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting in this case is that it does go on to what happens if the proofs can't be provided. But the focus of this passage is more about, or at least ostensibly about, the shame upon the woman. It says that the husband will have slandered a virgin of Israel. It's almost an odd phrase, a virgin of Israel. I do wonder if some of that focus goes to the nation of Israel. It's not just because a woman has been slandered. It's because it brings shame upon the whole nation.
And shame upon the woman's family.
Yeah, the fine that the false accuser has to pay goes to the woman's father.
Yes. And this is a way for her to be defended.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, this is her kind of recourse.
Yeah, because if there was no way to defend herself, then her husband could have just divorced her, and then she would have been not a virgin and not widowed, yep. And it would have been a struggle for her to get married again in the rest of her life. So, yes, she was in a vulnerable position.
Yes, yeah. As you said, the false accuser is forbidden from ever divorcing this particular wife, so it does protect her from that particular kind of abuse.
But then not from any ongoing abuse, because she's now married to someone who doesn't trust her and who wanted to divorce her so much that he was willing to publicly accuse her of not being a virgin. So you do wonder what sort of abuse she's then open to the rest of her life. And I know it's not the point of this passage. She is provided for, she is less vulnerable than being divorced, but it still isn't what we would consider these days an ideal outcome.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's significant that it isn't, that it is outside of the narrative. It's outside of the consideration of this law, because the focus, I guess in a sense, isn't really on the woman and the wrong that's been done to her. The focus is on what this means for the clan, what this means for the family, and for the inheritance of the land.
So, yeah, I think that's very true. Yeah. She is more the woman as a property of her father and this transaction, her marriage that has happened, rather than her feelings.
Yes. Yeah. That, which is really significant, because though, you know, as you said, ongoing abuse, if it falls completely outside the purview of this passage, then that is something where we have to, I think, probably confront that and say, the passage could go further, or rather, we should go further in seeking true justice and in truly seeking to eradicate that element of shame.
Absolutely. Like, we quite quickly to come to go, but what about this when we look at these laws today? And I think that's based on our understanding of other passages of scripture as well, and how we would aim to treat people as best as possible. But it's just not part of the consideration at this moment in time.
Yeah, exactly. It's useful to be confronted with that, to remember that this is a different world with a very specific worldview. And sometimes the ways in which we don't share that worldview come out really starkly.
Absolutely, yeah.
That's true of the next section, which is even more troubling. Or rather, it should be even more troubling. It'd be really easy just to kind of read these passages and gloss over them.
I think we'd like to do that sometimes, wouldn't we? And just be like, these are some old passages that were written a really long time ago. They don't apply today, so we're not going to worry about them.
Yes.
But they are still an important part of our Bible. They are still part of the understanding that Jesus would have had of the law, and that it based a lot of his teachings on. So even though we wouldn't want to take them verbatim today, we still need to acknowledge their part in history.
Yeah, that is really important. We believe that this is all about a community that had direct experience of God. And so when we look at it and say, actually, based on our convictions and on our faith in a loving God and in a God who values justice, we don't think that this is entirely the best way that this could be handled. That does make us ask important questions. And I think those are questions that were being asked continually throughout the use of these law codes, throughout the ways in which they're applied and described, especially by the Jewish rabbis and in Jewish commentary.
Yes, and the extent to which they were carried out. Maybe we could get that. Come back to that in a little bit.
Yes, that sounds like a good idea. So, this next section, there's three scenarios involving sex outside of marriage, involving first married, then betrothed, and then unbetrothed women. None of these scenarios have anything to say about whether or not the man is married. That's completely irrelevant to this passage, which is interesting because usually when we would describe something like adultery or some kind of sexual sin along those lines, hopefully we'd consider that would apply to both men and to women. Some of the scenarios do involve condemnation for the men in them, but that condemnation is never that they were already married.
I suppose that follows when you've got kings, well, you've got ordinary men having more than one wife.
Yep.
And the kings would have been allowed to have more than one wife, yeah, and to use concubines as well. We've got the example of Abraham, who was just given a servant as well. So they weren't routinely condemned for extra sexual relationships outside what we consider a norm, yeah, normal marriage.
Yeah. That's another of those details that's really easy to gloss over. But again, it should probably be a lot more jarring than it usually is, especially if we're going to try and derive some kind of moral guidance from any of these passages. There's kind of a big hole there that we have to address, a big gap.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And part of that's doing the work like today, isn't it? Going through and thinking, what did this mean for the people at the time when they first got these laws? What was the context and what was their understanding before we go on to think, what do we do about it today?
Yeah, exactly. The first of these scenarios, the man and a married woman who are, it says discovered, a man discovered lying with a married woman I guess this would apply to some kind of verified report. I don't know how that would work. If a man is convicted of having sex with a married woman, they're both to be put to death. And again, that the focus is on the cohesion of the community, ultimately of the nation itself. You must purge Israel of this wickedness. So this is not just a moral judgment of some kind. It also has a practical impact on the community itself.
It still seems like a harsh judgment, doesn't it?
Yeah, it kind of does.
Not much opportunity for repentance.
Yeah, there really isn't, is there? You did this, you're both going to die. It's interesting because by the time of Jesus in the first century, sort of Second Temple, rabbis had practically outlawed the death penalty. They'd basically made it impossible for anybody to be executed by applying such stringent requirements to a conviction that it was basically impossible. And that there's no evidence that that anyone was ever actually executed.
Really?
I don't think there's any evidence that anyone was executed for any of these crimes.
Ah, so maybe this is in part to convey the horror and the impropriety of the situation. Then when this happens in real life, we have a tendency to be more compassionate, don't we?
Yeah, I think so. It's a troubling kind of rhetoric. But I don't think it's entirely unreasonable to see it as a type of rhetoric as well.
Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about it like that before.
That might need a bit more research, other than it occurred to me while I was sitting in the car reading a podcast.
Interesting.
Okay, so the next scenario involves a betrothed woman. So this is when a virgin is pledged in marriage to a man, and another man encounters her in the town and lies with her. Then, again, they both have to be executed. But, or at least this is how I read it, I think it does imply that this is not consensual sex. So, another man comes across her and lies with her. It's not that that two people are discovered lying together. I don't know if that's something that a more modern sensibility brings to the passage.
I think the fact that she is a betrothed virgin gives you an indication that she would be less likely to have sex with a different man.
Yep.
And it also, the way it says, a man meets her in the city and lies with her. So it's not found lying together, as in verse 22. Yep. It seems to suggest that it's more something that is done to her. That's possibly one for the interpreters.
Yeah, it does also imply that she should be expected to cry for help. That's the reason given for convicting her, because she was in a town, there are going to be people around, and she should have cried out for help, says the text.
Yeah, so I think put all of those things together and it's fairly clear it's not consensual.
Yeah. So this scenario and the next scenario we're describing is rape.
Mm-hmm.
And again, there's a community focus. You must rid yourselves of this wickedness. But what really, I think, really should stick out in this passage is this sort of expectation that the victim of the crime in this case should have been responsible for rescuing herself from it in some way. And especially if we contrast that with the next part of this scenario from verse 25, there's a difference in that expectation that if the rape occurs outside of the town, in the country, verse 27, though the girl may have cried for help, there was no one to come to her rescue.
So in the first scenario, both the man and the woman are stoned to death because she didn't cry for help. And in the second scenario, only the man is stoned to death because even if she cried, there was no one there to rescue her.
Yeah, exactly, yes.
But that still doesn't sit well with us today, does it?
No, it really doesn't. The whole idea that the victim of the crime should have in some way been responsible for mitigating it or escaping from it, yeah, that's problematic, especially in this kind of crime, which is all about power, not just physical power, but psychological power as well, where the rapist is
probably
is trying.
The physically stronger one as well.
Yes, so it's
physically stronger. And we know that when women are raped, they freeze as well and don't necessarily, they're not necessarily able to fight back or to cry for help.
Yeah.
And it does very much feel like it's blaming the victim for being in the wrong place. Well, it is blaming the victim as well in this situation. The woman is blamed as well as the man.
Yes, yes, absolutely. In fact, the second part of that, where it takes place outside of a town, specifically says that the victim is blameless. Do nothing to the girl, no guilt deserving of death attaches to her. So, yeah, the implication is directly there, that if it takes place in a town, the victim is literally blamed.
Yeah. And that's worrying, because today we wouldn't think that's right. I'd hope we wouldn't. But actually, there's stories in the news time and time again where the victims continue to be blamed. In Ireland, there was the teenager who was blamed for the sort of underwear she was wearing when she was raped. And they were saying that because she was wearing a certain type of underwear, that she was going out looking to have sex.
Wow.
I know. And that was held up in court, and there's a reason for her to be blamed. And that's not an isolated case, isn't it?
No, there's all kinds of stories from the US, from the UK, all with this kind of same core. There were reports earlier this year that in England, it can be standard procedure for regional police departments to require access to a rape victim's phone before proceeding with any kind of arrest or conviction.
It's terrible, isn't it? The idea that just because maybe a day before or in the past or even a little while earlier, just the idea that because a victim at one point was maybe interested in a relationship with that man or she was happy to have sex with him, that then means she wasn't raped. So when we talk about consent, we're meaning enthusiastic consent when sex is actually happening. Whereas by the police taking people's phones and looking through their messages, they're then assuming that just because someone was maybe happy to have sex at a different point, then they are going to consent at any time. Whereas actually, we're all at liberty to change our minds whenever we want to. There's been other cases as well of people being blamed because of the clothes they're wearing. So someone is, say, on a night out and they are blamed for wearing clothes that are possibly too revealing. There was a UCL University art installation which showed all the different sorts of clothes that women were wearing. And they talk about should women be thinking, am I going to be raped because I'm wearing this or not? No, they should be free to wear whatever they want. And regardless of what they are wearing, it is always the rapist who is at fault. It is always, it is never the victim's fault. Whatever they're wearing or whatever situation they're in, they are never asking for it, which is sometimes what you could get the feeling of from reading things both on the news today and these passages in the Old Testament. Was she asking for it because she was out in the country and some potentially somewhere unsafe? Should a young woman remain in the city gates at all time so that they can cry for help? Well, I don't think ultimately it's necessarily going to keep them any safer, but it does skew the way we view these things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it's similar again to what you mentioned on the other half of the chapter, that the kind of ongoing effects of this particular kind of crime. Again, that's something that's outside of the scope of this particular narrative, that an experience of trauma doesn't necessarily end with an assault, and how the people around victims and how society itself and the justice system responds to these particular kinds of crimes.
Yeah, we know that there are really low rates of reporting cases of rape because people are often worried about being believed.
Yeah.
It's, as we discussed, the problem of providing evidence for virginity. It's still a difficult one to provide evidence for. And to give testimony in court and to relive the experiences that have happened to them, it's a really hard thing to come to terms with. Although people do manage to, it is a hard thing to come to terms with too. But then to have to report it and relive the experiences must be heartbreaking.
Yeah. Yeah, without question.
And I guess when people are, well, I'm thinking about reporting it to the police, but even maybe telling friends or family about what's happened to them, the response they get from the people around them can be really important, whether we are able to be supportive or whether we are judging them and possibly victim blaming as well. So although I think these are hard topics to talk about, I think they are important to talk about in our context of church and looking after the other people we're at the meeting with and our young people.
Yep, definitely. Okay, final scenario or final kind of part of this particular law code. In verses 28 and 29, we have an unbetrothed virgin and how the law treats the response to that rape. And here it's explicit that a man encounters a virgin who is not yet betrothed and forces her to lie with him, and they are discovered. So the narrative's unequivocal in this particular instance. This is definitely rape.
Absolutely. It's very hard to read that, isn't it? Because then the victim has to marry her rapist and live with them for the rest of her life. So potentially, if a man wanted someone to marry him and her family wouldn't agree, then this was a way of achieving that aim.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, it really brings home the way in which this society works. Women are treated more as property. This is more of a property crime than any other kind of crime, because there's a fine to pay to the father, the owner of the property. The form's quite similar to the other property crimes that are in Deuteronomy and in Leviticus.
I wonder in reality how often a couple is literally found doing the deed. I think more often it's likely that a young woman becomes pregnant. And then they ask, well, who's the father to this?
Yeah.
And then it comes out. So, like, this is really, really trying to be optimistic here. That maybe this has something to do with looking after the children as well. Because then if you end up with an unmarried mother, she's not going to be able to get married again. The children are illegitimate. The child is illegitimate and has a very hard life ahead.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how much that is based in reality, but that's me being a little bit hopeful.
Yeah, it is kind of hard to say. There's probably some good reasons to go down that line. Other contemporary law codes, like the Babylonian law code of Hammurabi, has provisions that are more horrific, but also provisions that are more similar to that kind of line. So just to take a couple of examples. There was a water trial in the Code of Hammurabi that a woman was expected to throw herself into a river. She was supposed to volunteer for this particular kind of trial if she was accused of committing adultery, which is quite a long way further into horrifying than Deuteronomy 22 gets. A husband could also buy himself out of a marriage. If he wanted to, he could pay. Obviously, he would pay the father. And a woman could be divorced for, I'm quoting here, engaging in business. If she leaves the house to go and engage in business, that was itself grounds for divorce.
So those laws feel like it's very much double standard.
Yeah, totally. But then by the same token, a woman could divorce her husband and take her dowry and herself back to her father's house if it could be proved that her husband had disparaged her. under the law code of Hammurabi, which might not necessarily be easy to prove, given that you'd have to rely on witnesses to badmouth the husband.
Yes.
But by the same token, that does that goes quite a long way in the other direction.
It does, actually.
Allow the woman to take some agency. I was actually quite surprised by that one.
That's an interesting one.
It's a bit of a minority report, so there aren't many like it in which the woman has some agency in a particular part of that law code. It's usually the husband addressing wrongs or perceived wrongs against himself. Mm. Interesting that it's there, though.
Yeah, it is.
But it does go to show, again, that the laws in Deuteronomy are part of this ancient Near Eastern world.
Yeah, and they only really make sense as laws and some measures to possibly try and protect women from abuse, but in a society where abuse is always systemic.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it looks good compared to, like, rampant abuse of women, treating them like disposable sex toys. It looks good compared to that, but that's the lowest
possible bar. It's a low bar, really, isn't it?
Exactly. It's like the lowest possible bar.
And we look at Jesus' treatment of the woman caught in adultery.
Yes.
And that was very different to what we're seeing here.
Yep.
He asked the crowd around if they were innocent to cast the first stone.
Yep.
Is that right?
Yep.
Yep. And nobody did.
Yeah.
So him knowing these laws doesn't mean that's how he demanded that they were carried out.
Yes. Exactly. Jesus' approach to that isn't uncommon in that particular time period when the rabbis of Second Temple Judaism were drawing spiritualized lessons out of these ancient law codes already. I mean, we say that that's the kind of thing that we do, to take it out of its world and context and put it into another one. But the rabbis of Jesus' time were already doing that.
Oh, that sounds interesting. Can you give me an example of that?
Yes, so the laws around rape that we've just been looking at, the spiritualized kind of lesson that the rabbis pulled out of that, was that a person can't be held liable for a wrong committed under compulsion. So if you're forced
like
to
coercion do something, and things like that.
Yeah. So if you're forced to do something, it wasn't your fault, you can't be convicted for it.
Okay.
Which is really generalized, a really, really generalized lesson.
Yeah,
out of a very specific law.
And a lot more compassionate.
Yep.
And allowing for circumstances and explanation from the victims as to what happened.
Exactly.
Than these, the sort of cut and dryness of these laws.
Yeah. And it implies that you have to trust a person when they make that claim as well.
It does, yeah.
So we've got a fairly good precedent for, I suppose in some ways, treating these laws as existing on a trajectory, I guess, a trajectory of moral justice.
Yeah, and this is the starting point, isn't it? These were the first laws that were written down and that we can still see today.
Yeah.
But these were not the final ones for all time.
Exactly.
And I'm not sure if that quite makes sense or if that's a bit...
No, it does make sense. There's an expectation, or throughout history, there's been an expectation that these laws and these law codes aren't the final word on anything.
Okay.
I think that's probably fair to say.
Yeah. Okay. And even today, laws get reworked every so often, don't they?
Yep.
When there's new understanding or ways of working, or there's been new cases, haven't they? And people have learnt from how justice has been dealt out and tried to do it better in the future.
Yeah. Yep. The world around us and the societies around us change. So.
Yes, and the laws have to reflect that.
Yeah. Well, that wraps up our conversation with Deuteronomy 22. So at this point, Joe and I would like us all to observe a minute of silence for the victims and survivors of rape and sexual assault. Perhaps this would be a good time to contemplate the responsibility that Scripture enjoins on us all to pursue justice and fight the rape culture of our own societies. It's certainly a good time to pray for victims and survivors and resolve to support and believe them. That was a really valuable conversation. Thanks so much for coming on to talk through these challenging passages. I think that was really helpful.
No problem at all. I hope it will be useful for people who are listening, because sometimes we can read these passages, and because they're hard conversations to have, really, that we brush over them quite quickly and we're like, oh yeah, that wasn't great. But I think it is still worth spending the time looking at them and thinking about how we treat women and how we treat people who have been raped today.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks, Dan, for letting me come on your podcast.
Thank you very much for coming on the podcast. 4 Cubits and a Span will be returning with more content soon on the podcast feed and on the website. Join the mailing list on the website, www.4cubitsandaspan.com, to be kept up to date of new posts there. You can like and follow the Facebook page. I'll share and post links to new blog posts and new podcasts on there as well. So until next time, God bless, take care, and we'll speak again soon.
Are we done with the official bit now?
Yes.
Excellent. Awesome. We should do this another time when I don't have to say words like sex in public.
We should. It's not at all uncomfortable.